listening to Trending with Timory, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timory holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
It's so good to be with all of you yet again. I have a special treat for all of you, quite a surprise. My former co-host from when we were running Hearts and Minds, Trent Horn, is here with me in studio. It's so great to have you, Trent.
Hi. It is good to be back.
You have, over the last couple years, had multiple books come out, with one, which we're going to talk about today, Made This Way, which you wrote with Layla Miller. What other books have come out over the last couple years for those who maybe haven't stayed up to speed with your work?
Well, since our time together on Hearts and Minds, I've continued writing. I think I'm finishing up now. I think it's my eighth book, actually.
Congratulations.
So I just want to get to 13. And then just on my bio, I can just leave it as he's written over a dozen books and not have to change it or update it.
So no one will be counting anymore.
I don't even. It's like kids. It's like, how many do I have? How many? Writing books is sort of like raising kids. At this point, I don't really know how many I have, but I will tell you this. I made all my mistakes on my first one.
He's talking about his books, not his kids.
It's kind of both, honestly. Anyone who is, like, I've written eight books. Anyone who has eight kids will say, I forget a few of them every now and then, and I made all my mistakes on the first one. And, like, when I go back and look at my earlier writing, yeah. But I'm still happy with it. So I since our time on Hearts and Minds, I wrote Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love. And that book, I think, has done very well. It's sold over 150,000 copies, and a lot of people have found it helpful as just a basic primer for why you should be Catholic. And it's a book you can give to anybody.
And I love reading your books, Trent, because I always have heard that a good author, you can hear their voice when you're reading their writing, and I can hear your
Sorry to hear that.
No, it's good because it means it's clear usually and that there's animation behind the words. So I always love reading your work because there's a clarity that not a lot of writers have.
Yeah, I'll give you this. I hate reading certain Catholic writers that write to be pretentious. There are some people, the very first line of the book, I can tell it's going to be a bad book, that they're writing to try to impress other people instead of just clearly communicating the idea they want to put forward. So Why We're Catholic, my goal there was to write a book that anyone with an eighth grade education or higher could read and appreciate. Right. Then after that, I decided to go into deeper waters and I wrote The Case for Catholicism, which is just on answering Protestant arguments against the Catholic faith. It was written more for if you have an undergraduate education, I think would be best for that audience. And I published that with Ignatius Press. And then shortly after that, I wrote Made This Way with Layla Miller about how to explain the church's moral teachings on 10 tough issues, especially to children, little kids and big kids. But it's funny, I found the book has been helpful even to people of all ages in helping them better understand the church's teachings on morality and especially sexual morality.
Don't go away because we're actually going to be working through some of the key arguments and developing how you develop your work and Made This Way, because you break it down in a really great way. You show what the Catholic Church teaches, and then you also show how to talk about these issues both with prepubescent children and pubescent children, which is really different because we don't want to cause scandal or overexpose children too soon. And I know that's a question I often receive from people as well. How much can I say to my child that's 12 years old, right on the fence in terms of what she's aware of, he or she is aware of? So these are really important questions, and we want to recommend that book that you and Layla Miller wrote over just this past year, a couple months ago, that it was released. Before we jump into that, though, I was actually just learning the last week that there was a major meeting that took place in San Diego County, all over the county, multiple locations for the San Diego teachers on January 7th. And what took place in the meeting is they were actually really pushing forward the LGBTQIA continued agenda for these teachers.
At least kids will learn their letters.
I know. At least they'll know. I have got it as far up to the A right now. I think you have it. Let's hear it.
LGBTQQIA. AI2SP, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, intersex, ally, androgynous, two-spirit and pansexual, which will be, that'll be the wild card in a few years.
Pansexual?
Pansexual. That means I'm attracted to people, not bodies. It's basically putting bisexuals out of business.
And this isn't a joke because I was speaking at a conference about one or two summers ago, and one of the girls raised her hand. She said, well, what about me? I'm pansexual. Mm-hmm. And that was just the question she had, very honest and clear.
Yeah, it's the idea that bodies aren't what matters. It's the person or the mind. And so someone who is pansexual is, they don't have a preference for either men or women or gender. It's funny that the acronym, I really think the B is going to go away.
Bisexual.
Because bisexual implies the dreaded gender binary, that there are men and women, mm-hmm. and you're exclusively attracted to one, the other, or both. But pansexual, it's like there's really not a difference. Pansexual means you're attracted regardless of gender. So bisexual is the idea you're attracted to someone regardless of sex.
So could pansexual enter into the area of bestiality, being attracted to animals?
Most people draw the line there, at least for public relations reasons. Miley Cyrus would be a famous example of this a few years ago. She said she came out as pansexual, saying, anything with a consenting adult is okay with me. And so she draws a line at adults and at humans, but logically speaking, there, you know, it,
if it's a body, what else matters?
Yeah, what is it? Well, they would say, I guess, they're attracted to persons specifically, not bodies, so animals aren't persons. But I think the argument against bestiality, and a point I always make to people, and I always say that, you know, that's never a topic one enjoys bringing up, zoophilia, the other word, the more technical term for it, people will say, well, look, you're totally off your wagon if you're going to compare our sexual behavior to bestiality, because that hurts animals and we're not hurting anybody. And my response to that is, well, if it's okay for us to eat animals, or at the very least, if we're not murderers, if we eat animals, we do far more harm to animals by eating them than we would with sexual relations with them. So if people are allowed to harm animals by eating them, why couldn't they harm them with these other behaviors? So the point is that if you reduce sexuality merely to the exchange of pleasurable feelings, you really lose those common sense boundaries the traditional sexual ethic once had.
Such as saying that going toward animals or children is too far, those boundaries are pulled
away. Right,
yeah,
because if we say that sexuality is meant for humans, why should we believe that? Why? Well, one traditional reason, the natural law view, which we'll talk about later, is that what we see when human beings, their sexual organs are designed for the good of procreation. That would make sense then why humans have sex with humans and not other species, because it's ordered towards that good. But if that's the reason, you order towards procreation, suddenly behaviors that are not of their nature ordered towards procreation, like homosexual behavior, for example, would become disordered. So in trying to bring in other sexual behaviors, you're going to have to let other behaviors in as well.
So in talking about this pansexual, where mm-hmm. it doesn't really matter male or female, we're cutting that out. That's kind of where this meeting was going,
right,
in many ways,
mm-hmm.
on the January 7th, because what they actually asked the teachers, they said, from now on, we want to refer to all children as you, they, no more she, he, boy, girl, the thabies, exactly. So it's not just those kids who are identifying as being transgender or are maybe attracted to the opposite sex and so forth, or the same sex. It doesn't matter what it is. They're saying you need to refer to everyone as those, you know, gender neutral pronouns.
Even children who identify as male or female?
Yes, absolutely. And so this took place just in San Diego on the 7th.
Okay.
Of course, San Diego. Actually,
California, yeah, the left coast. Go ahead.
I know one of the priests was saying, hey, if I didn't have to be here, kind of stationed here at my parish, I would be leaving California at this point. And I think that this meeting, though, is really mm-hmm. making clear to a lot of teachers who are on the fence, okay, where they need to stand on this issue. In fact, I was just talking to someone in the charter school system, because
right.
even in the charter school system, a lot of people look at it as a safe haven,
yeah.
but they're dealing with the same thing. Although a lot of the people in some of the charter schools kind of have similar faith-based
right.
views, or maybe even don't have a faith type of view, but say, hey, there's
common sense view,
male and female. Well, they're now being sued in certain circumstances yeah. over kids who are experiencing transgenderism. One case just over the last couple weeks, a kid who's transgender was on the same kind of plan with his parents, and the next thing you know, he now decided that he doesn't agree with his parents. So this is the other thing that's been taking place in the meetings.
Yeah.
Parents should no longer be notified if their child is experiencing transgenderism or any type of same-sex attraction, because the educators are being told that the parents are ill-equipped to help their children.
Of course. Here's a weird irony of this. So on the one hand, we're supposed to refer to children not as boys or girls. They're just right. they, bees, or you. They're essentially asexual beings that we educate. But on the other hand, you have things like Title IX. You have federal and state laws that demand that sex discrimination not take place in schools to make sure that girls don't suffer from a hostile educational environment simply because they are girls, for example, right. and make sure, you know, sexual harassment doesn't take place. So wait, how do you make sure that especially girls are not being victimized because of their sex in schools when you refuse to acknowledge boys and girls exist at all? So the two just, you know, they run like loggerheads into each other, and it's just completely chaotic. It doesn't make any sense.
They're clashing. That's what's interesting. Yeah. Even some of the bathroom laws that were being put into place for using transgender bathrooms and so forth, that was, they were trying to use Title IX to justify this. But if you read the language, it had to do with upholding respect for women,
right.
which had been so little respected in our society in some ways. And now we've gotten to the point where we're saying, well, now there are no differences between male and female. We're going to first elevate women and now obliterate the changes.
But then here's the problem. If there's no differences between men and women, then we can't say that men are oppressing women. And we'll talk about that later with patriarchy and the APA. I thought if either there are no differences or there are differences men take advantage of, you can't have your feminist cake and eat it too.
Absolutely. So these are issues we're going to dive into because maybe you're having these conversations with your children.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe your 7-year-old came home and said, Mommy, can God make mistakes? Could he make a little boy actually a little girl? Or my friend now says that she's a little boy. And, you know, these questions that I think some parents panic when they hear them. So we're
sure.
going to walk through these tough issues. I have in studio with me Trent Horn of Catholic Answers. It's great to have you with us. Where can people find you on social media?
They can find me on Facebook and Twitter if they just search Trent Horn Catholic Apologist, or they can always check out TrentHornPodcast.com.
Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's TIMMERIE. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Timmery here in studio with me is Trent Horn, Catholic apologist from Catholic Answers, and my former co-host from Hearts and Minds. Mm-hmm. Before we go any further, we're going to be walking through today Trent Horn's book, Made This Way, helping to equip you as a parent on what to say, how to say it to both prepubescent and pubescent children, challenging you on these tough moral issues, mm-hmm. or preventatively forming them to live as Christians in the modern world. But I want to really invite you, I mentioned before the last segment that there was a meeting in San Diego area for many of the teachers really pushing the LGBTQ agenda and how they can no longer refer to their children, any children in the classroom, as male, female, or they're encouraging them not to. And also that you should not talk to parents about any issues a child might be having with their sexuality or quote unquote identity. So there's a meeting taking place on February 2nd in San Diego. It's a rally outside of one of the meetings for the school district. And so I'm going to be posting things on social media. They're hoping to have about 1,000 parents, teachers there at least, to speak up against this radical agenda that's truly sexualizing our children.
It's bizarre because normally parents would be informed if their children exhibited, say, we believe your child has an eating disorder, for example, we believe your child has hyperactivity disorder, which I think is actually not really, it's misdiagnosed usually. Hyperactivity disorder in a lot of cases is just boys not allowed to have recess.
Amen to that.
Yeah, so because we're going to talk about masculinity a little bit later. That here, it's normally parents are encouraged to be involved in their child's education. They're told if there's something, we suspect there's something, your child is suffering from some kind of psychological illness, or they're experiencing some kind of hardship at school, even if their grades aren't going well, you tell the parents. But yet in this one area of sexuality, it's a very Orwellian, well, we know what's best and we have to indoctrinate you. That's why, frankly, I'm not a big fan of the term public schools. I prefer the term government schools. That's what they are. They're government schools that teach government propaganda.
But Trent, this is the same exact thing that we saw happen with the abortion issue.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen for years that anything, whether it's taking a Tylenol at school, is not allowed unless they have parent consent.
Right.
But if you desire an abortion, those school officials could take you off campus and never notify your parent. Now, the same thing, because it has to do with sex and sexual liberation and an agenda, they're now telling teachers, we're going to bring in the specialists to help affirm LGBTQ type feelings and experiences and not work to help the child and the family as a whole unit.
Yeah, despite the fact that studies have shown 80% of children who experience identifying as the other gender, I don't like the word gender, who identify as the other sex,
right.
They eventually cease to identify that way when they reach puberty and they reach adulthood. So 4 out of 5 times, they abandon these other identities. And yet, in these cases with, you know, you've got 6, 7-year-old, 5-year-old children, you're going to be setting them on a self-destructive path, especially if you give them things like hormone blocker replacement, try to get them involved in sex reassignment surgery. This is child abuse, plain and simple.
Right. It's lifelong mutilation to the members of the body, and psychologically just the impact that has in a child, years where they need to know unconditional love, not that they need to be changed and manipulated. So let's talk about your book, Made This Way. You wrote it with Layla Miller, who's a mother of 8 children, good friend I know of both of us, and yourself, who has, you have 2 younger children as well. And so it's great because they're both ends of the spectrum. She has older children who are kind of married and grandchildren, and you're also dealing with younger babies as well.
Yes.
And so these are issues, though, you may not send your kids to, as you call them, the government-run schools, but if your kids spend time around them, they may hear topics like, well, what's gay, mommy? You know, what's gay? Like asking these issues.
Oh, yeah. You, even if you choose to homeschool a child, unless you keep them in a bunker on a compound and they never leave, they're going to be exposed to the outside world to varying degrees, and they're going to stumble upon things that will be an affront to their innocence. And so what Layla and I talk about in our book, Made This Way, is that you ought to try to preserve the innocence of your children as long as you can, because it's a precious gift that they have, but you should be prepared if that innocence is taken away from them, if they're exposed to something through media or being out and about in public, to be able to give them a calm and a clear answer. So that's why the Truth and Meaning of Human Sexuality, which is from the Pontifical Council of the Family, it says, in a positive and prudent way, parents will carry out what the fathers of the Second Vatican Council requested, to give suitable and timely instruction to young people, while making sure that the period of tranquility and serenity for your little children is not unnecessarily disturbed.
And I love that the church recognizes this based on human development, based on the innocence, based on even our ability to sin, what we want to preserve in our young people. So in the book, you guys talk about parenting, and you talk about 2 extremes of parenting.
Yes.
And I think this is important because I think this is where it all sort of starts. So talk about those 2 extremes of parenting and where we need to find that middle ground.
Sure. And I can understand these extremes because I swing through them, being a fallible parent myself of a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. So on the one extreme, basically the idea is, how do you instruct children? How do you raise them up to be good children? And one idea is to believe that rules are necessary to instill fear and obedience in children. That would be authoritarian parenting. The authoritarian parent says, you know, do what I say because I say so, and that's it. And disobedience is punished harshly and swiftly. Authoritarian parents are not characterized by discipline. They're characterized by harsh, inflexible discipline that is often cruel. That's a way sometimes for the parent to take out their own frustrations on the child through overly harsh, rigid discipline. It's I say so,
which usually ends up having a negative outcome.
Yeah, it may get you short term gains of a child who's obedient, but they won't learn how to self regulate. They obey out of fear, they don't live according to principles of reason to know what makes sense, how I should live. They don't learn how to regulate their own internal desires to act in different ways. So that's the authoritarian model. The other model is the permissive model, which says the way I love my children is by giving them what they want and not giving them a bunch of rules. But that also, it's very different from the authoritarian model, but it has the same end. The child doesn't learn how to regulate their own internal desires.
This is also the type of parent who's also like, my kid's my best friend, you can do whatever you want. And they kind of affirm a lot of different actions, like, good on you, you know?
Yeah. And so what we say in the book is that authoritarian parents say, I'm not your friend, I'm your parent. And then the permissive parent says, I'm not your parent, I'm your friend. We believe the middle ground. Layla and I believe the best model is called authoritative parenting. well, basically, we call it being a friendly parent. So you're not your child's friend. You're not supposed to be. You have to be an example to them and set limits and discipline. Hebrews chapter 12 of the Bible even says that we have had fathers who've disciplined us for our good. How much more so will our Heavenly Father discipline us? So we're not friends, but we're not also cold, harsh, inflexible tyrants. We're friendly parents. We set rules and limits for a child's good, for their ultimate well-being, and we show them warmth and compassion and openness. One of the hard things with these moral issues, some authoritarian parents, the child says, well, what does it mean to be gay? Well, hey, we don't talk about that in this house. And you get in trouble for even asking an honest question. Mm-hmm. That leads you to be repressed, to seek answers out from less than reliable or helpful sources.
In a Google search, it very quickly turns up, unless you use the right wording, probably things that you wouldn't want your child to be searching for and trying to understand.
If you don't teach your child about these things, somebody else will. So don't delude yourself with the idea that if you just ignore these things, they're going to go away. If you abdicate your responsibility to teach your children, someone else will take up that mantle, and it's probably someone you don't want teaching your children. So that's why we give in the book helpful steps to how to understand what the church teaches on these moral issues, how to explain them to children prior to puberty who may stumble upon them, and then how to explain them to kids after puberty, even adult children, even your fellow adults, who might have, you know, tougher questions and objections.
And I've heard some great examples of parenting such as this, where maybe their child, young man, is struggling with pornography addiction, mm-hmm. or they're starting to look at pornography and they find it's becoming a repetitive behavior, and they're comfortable enough to talk to a parent about it or to seek out help or say, hey, this is going on, knowing that, yeah, it's wrong. But the parent's going to love them enough to say, hey, let's work on some resources. Let's take care of this struggle you're experiencing.
The number one rule we try to put forward from Layla's advice, especially being a veteran parent, is this. Don't freak out. Your kid brings you something. Just even if you feel the temptation to freak out, ask them a question like, where did you hear this? How long has this been happening? Why do you feel this way? Just ask them a question so you can collect yourself.
Before you freak out in terms of what you're being asked.
Yeah, and it allows you to tamp yourself down. Because if you freak out, you have to be the moral foundation for them. Because they're confused. They're scared about these different feelings they have about knowing what's right and what's wrong. And so you're that foundation. And so the goal here is just to not freak out. You can even say, I need some time to think about this. You're not in trouble. Well, I mean, they could be in trouble. if they're asking, though, an honest question, you can say, I'm not going to yell at you. I don't want to make you feel bad. Let me think about this for a bit so we can have a good conversation about it. If that's what you need to do, go ahead and do that. It's always better to refrain from talking than it is to say something you're going to regret to your children. I have learned that from constant experience.
I have a friend who's very, very modest, and she tells a story of her two squirrely boys sitting in the back seat, and one of them yells from the back seat to his mom, about 3-4 years old, Mom! Or no, probably closer to 4. Mom, what's a condom? And the older brother, who's like in first or second grade, goes, it's a balloon for your bleep.
Right.
And then the younger one goes, oh, okay. And the mom in the front seat is like aghast, makes his face and kind of like shrieked almost. And then the other brother said something that was so simple that it allowed her to just move past it. And she said, oh, wow, I could have simplified it. And my other son kind of did that for me without me trying to think of this complicated
way. And here's a prime example of that. Well, what's a condom? You might be thinking, oh, great, how am I supposed to explain this right now? When what I would say is, where did you hear about condoms?
Right.
You start right there. Where did you hear about a condom? Who told you about that? And I might ask, what do you think it is? And, you know, and then let them work through. And that allows me to see where they are and to know whether I have to give more or less information.
And whether maybe even on their own, they're recognizing that something's right or wrong, and you can appeal to where their reasoning is going.
Right.
We're
going
to come back. I want to talk for a second here. What is the difference between education and indoctrination? Very briefly, kind of give a 1-2 sentence summary of that.
Sure. Well, they're basically the same thing. Indoctrination is just a word people use when you try to educate your children in religious truths, saying that you're brainwashing them.
But that's what people say we're doing by giving this episode.
But look what's happening in kindergarten today. The government schools are really indoctrinating students. So every child is going to be, quote unquote, indoctrinated. The question is, are you going to teach them? Doctrinaires means to teach. Are you going to teach them, or let someone who doesn't have their best interests at heart be the one who teaches them?
We'll be right back on Trending.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's TIMMERIE. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
In studio with me today is Catholic apologist from Catholic Answers, Trent Horn. We are talking about his book that he wrote with Layla Miller titled Made This Way. It's helping you as a parent, and I'm not going to put this just on parents. This is for any of you who maybe interact, nieces and nephews, maybe you're a school teacher, or maybe you have a hard time even talking to friends and family members about these issues. It helps us to simplify the tough moral issues. So Trent, you are really using natural law. You talk about what the church teaches, you clarify it, but in discussing this with young children right. and teenagers, you're utilizing natural law. Can you clarify what that is?
Natural law, as St. Thomas Aquinas says, is a rational creature's participation in the eternal law of God. So, simplest way to put it, basically the universe is not an accident, didn't just come from nothing. God created the universe. God is the source of all goodness and perfection. And so God created the universe and he wants it to be a certain way. Things are supposed to go a certain way. And so among nature, some things go that way just automatically from the laws of nature. You know, I drop this water bottle, it's going to fall and hit terminal velocity. So that's a law of nature. Natural law refers to a rational creature that, unlike the bottle of water that falls down, it can't choose whether to fall or not. But I can choose whether or not I'm going to push it or a person off of a high structure. So the natural law is the rational creature discerning what God's will is for the world, what the eternal law is, how the world should be. And this is not a strictly religious concept.
It's recognizing that there's a purpose for how we're made, which is why you put the title made this way. So just like a chair, you sit on a chair, right? You might be able to use it for burning things, among other things, but the purpose of the chair is to be sat on.
Yeah.
The purpose of a fork, what do we do with a fork? We eat with it, right?
Yeah, and we do the same thing. Even if you go to a biology 101 class at university, people will use this kind of language. They'll say the eye is for seeing, the lungs are for absorbing oxygen. So then we can see there are things that are contrary to the goods of our body, like, you know, stabbing needles in our eyes or inhaling substances that destroy the alveoli in our lungs. We look at other parts of our body. If we say, well, if eyes are for seeing and lungs are for breathing, what are the other parts for and what contradicts their use? Or how, you know, basically when I try to teach natural law to young people of any age, they should ask two questions. What is a thing and what is it for, or what is its purpose? And when we talk about a lot of these issues, I'll return to those important questions. You know, what is it for? But this, as I said, this is something any reasonable person can apprehend, even someone who's non-religious. So Martin Luther King Jr., someone who's a hero to religious and non-religious people alike, when he sat in the Birmingham jail after being convicted of violating segregation laws, he didn't think he did anything wrong because they're unjust laws. People said, well, how do you know it's just or unjust? This is what he said. He said, a just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God, that there's an overarching moral law, way we ought to treat one another, that we ourselves should try to emulate or follow.
And it's such a way of living. You know, I love the example, too, that Layla Miller gives, where she talks about how if you're a co-author, for those who don't know,
right.
of the book, she said, you know, if I were to take molasses and put it into the car,
right.
the car wouldn't run properly. And, you know, to be really vulgarly blunt, but to be frank, if you engage in anal sex, guess what? STD levels have skyrocketed across the country because of anal sex interactions, because mm-hmm. the body parts aren't made to go this way. And you can look, in some ways, the same thing with the molasses in the car. You need gas for the car.
There was an interesting, I've tried to find a record of this public service announcement a while back. There was the guy from Will and Grace. I think it was Jack. And he's a character with same-sex attractions on the show from back in the 90s, and Will and Grace. And it was an anti-smoking public service announcement. And he takes a cigarette, he says, it doesn't go here. It doesn't go here. You know, he puts a cigarette in his ear and in his nose. He says, and it doesn't go here, and puts it in his mouth. And it was just horrible irony here to think, like, here's this gentleman's, where does it go? Well, yeah, it doesn't go in your mouth because it causes grave harm to you. That's not what it's for. Even there, you know, a cigarette is an artificial object manufactured for a certain purpose. So the guys over at Marlboro would say, well, it does go there. That's what we made it for. Right. But it contradicts the natural good of our body. So you have an even stronger case with your own body parts to say it doesn't go there because you can clearly see what its purpose is, what it is for.
You know, it's reminding me of the one ad. One of the airlines a couple years ago, we might have been working together when it came out.
It was KLM.
Yeah, it was KLM. And they had all these different seatbelts. And it said, you can click with whoever you want. And it was a pro-LGBTQ agenda.
And it was so ironic because it's got the traditional male-female end. Two male ends and two female ends.
It doesn't work that way. You won't be safe.
It's like, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter until you hit turbulence or you crash and then one's going to work and the other's just not going to work.
And then you get a ticket for not having your seatbelt on.
I don't think they give you a ticket. I think they just kick.
Not on an airplane, but in a car, if you were to say the same thing.
To the officer.
It doesn't work that way. There's a purpose to your seatbelt.
That's right.
So let's talk about this in terms of the different moral issues. Yeah. You're going to have kids who are starting to really ask these questions about, for example, sex outside of marriage.
Right.
How do you start to talk to a young, let's say prepubescent, like 4-year-old like your son, about sex outside of marriage?
Well, what the Pontifical Council for the Family recommends, or Vatican Council for the Family recommends, is that children should learn about sexual reproduction and the purposes of our bodies. Early on, their sex education should not be genital based. It should be based on the idea that a husband and wife, a mother and father, have a special love for one another. And from that love, a new human life comes into existence. And so their introduction should be to see how mommy and daddy have a special love for each other. And that makes a baby come into existence in the mommy's womb. And so you should try to stray away from, you know, genital activity, especially if someone as young as like 4 or 5 years old. But you could use euphemisms. I might say things like, you know, the daddy gives a mommy a seed and mommies and daddies are married and love each other. And that seed grows in the mommy's belly and becomes a baby. And then the baby comes out of mommy and you used to be in mommy's belly or the womb. Sometimes belly, they think stomach, like, well, no, it was a special area of mommy's body called the womb. Then as they get older and understand the purposes of the body, you can say that, and this even works both for late prepubescent, like, you know, 8 through 10, and then even past pubescent. I recommend talking about the language of the body. I find that to be a helpful way, you know, talk about how that we should ask, well, what is sex for? What is marriage for? And the answers that make the most sense is it's an expression of lifelong permanent love. And so expressing that kind of love outside of the marital context is inauthentic. It's deceptive. It's lying with your body. It hurts you. It hurts this other person and has the potential to hurt a third innocent person, the baby who might come into existence, who has a right to be conceived within the marital act. We often don't look at sexual ethics from the kid's perspective sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and it makes you even turn back to simple sayings like the same, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes a baby in a baby carriage.
Right.
Very simple teaching, again, not going as deep as we can and should even with little kids, but it's a start, right? And even the example of using the seed analogy is a great example as well. So here are some tough questions that I often hear and have even been asked myself by young kids.
Sure.
One example is, you know, a friend comes to school wearing a dress and has a purse. And this is just a comment a kid makes to their parents just a couple weeks ago. Yeah, you know, this little boy is now dressing as a little girl wearing a dress and he's got a purse. And that's all he says. And the parent's going, oh no, I want to be accepting, but what do I say?
And I think what we can say here is try not to tread into territory unnecessarily. First, you can say, well, we should be kind to people even if they dress differently than we do. I mean, you know, here's some guys in Scotland playing the bagpipes. They wear these things called kilts, you know, and they wear that. And, you know, we might think it's odd or interesting, but we should be kind to other people even if they dress differently than we do. So just starting at something very basic, that doesn't mean we should endorse every kind of behavior someone does to their fashion, because in some cases it's cultural and other cases it's disordered, because in this case we don't know exactly what's happening here. This could be a 7-year-old who identifies as a girl dressing as a girl, or it could be a 7-year-old boy who identifies as gender nonconforming, a boy who just likes to dress up as a girl. So you can then reaffirm, but you know, boys and girls are different. And God made us to be different. And so boys act a certain way and girls act a certain way. And that's good for us. And some people are confused about the way boys and girls are supposed to act. And so we should pray for those people that they're not confused and that so they can grow up to be, you know, really healthy boys or really healthy girls that God made them to be. And I think when you take that approach, then you don't come off as judgmental. You come off as having common sense and compassion, and you can instill that in your children.
So then what if the kid takes it a step further and maybe says something like, why does that man want to be a lady?
And you can go back there to say, well, he may feel sad inside about being a man. He may think that, you know, he doesn't have what it takes to be a man. I'm not good enough to be a man, and maybe I'll feel better if I'm a girl. And so we should pray for him. And so we're looking here, we're having compassion on someone who has an identity disorder, but at the same time to affirm, but there are going to be, and to tell your child, there are going to be people who will tell you that this man really is a woman just because he thinks he's a woman. Does that make sense to you? If mommy says she's a 7 foot tall basketball player, is mommy a 7 foot tall basketball player? If I say that I'm, you know, a 5 foot tall model, you know, I'm not, you know, you use things like height or weight. Or if I say that, you know, we have our, you know, let's say you have your little dog at home, your little Cocker Spaniel, could I be a Cocker Spaniel? Would you take me to the vet or take me to the doctor?
You can almost hear the little kids' responses giggling at you as you're giving these different examples. Yeah. No, you know, yeah. Response.
So what we should say is to have compassion on people, say some people, and say, no, these are funny examples, but some people, it's very sad. They're very, very confused about who they are, and so we should pray for them. And people will tell you you're wrong about that, but let me tell you a story. It's called The Emperor's New Clothes. That's a great story for little kids to say, there was once, you know, an emperor, and these guys came in and said, we'll make you the greatest robes in the world, but guess what? Only smart people can see them. And they pretended to make clothes, but of course they were invisible. There was nothing there, but no one wanted to admit it because they didn't want people to think they were dumb. Like, oh yeah, I can see them because only smart people can see them. And so then, of course, at the end of the story, a little boy says, he's not wearing any clothes. And you can be that person. And I think that story has a lot of profound connections to the transgender debate we have now.
These are great questions that we will be coming back talking more about. Please check out Trent Horn's book, Made This Way. I know it's a great resource for many of you who are parents, teachers, educators, or just want to simplify and know what the church teaches and be able to better explain it with analogies to other people.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
So good to be with all of you. In studio with me is Trent Horn, Catholic apologist from Catholic Answers, and we're talking about his and Layla Miller's book, Made This Way, which was published just last year by Catholic Answers. I want to talk about some of the analogies that you use, Trent, in your book, because you're trying to break it down in ways for little kids or teenagers can understand. So let's talk, for example, about same-sex marriage. What's a good analogy or example you give in this instance?
Sure. When it comes to the issue of same-sex marriage, we don't want to fall into the trap of saying people of the same sex can't get married because, and you know, fill in the blank. We have to go back to a prior question. What is marriage, or what is marriage for? Mm-hmm. And so in the book, we show that there are essential elements of marriage everybody, nearly everyone agrees on, that marriage is something government recognizes. It's permanent or ideally permanent. There's only two people. Marriage is about a union of only two people. And there's a sexual element to marriage. You know, marriage is not purely platonic. You know, you don't have fathers marrying their sons just purely for tax benefits, things like that. So what explains all these elements? And we show in the book only the conjugal view of marriage, that just marriage is for the public recognition of the life-giving bond that exists between men and women. And it's good for society to keep men and women together because they tend to have babies, and it's good to have that particular bond. Just because some people can share elements of those bonds, it doesn't follow that they have that. So when you bring up this argument, people will say, yeah, but what about infertile couples? You know, infertile couples are allowed to get married, and they can't have kids. Why can't this same-sex couple get married? Well, an infertile couple who by some kind of accident or illness of some kind cannot have children is not the same as a same-sex couple who by nature cannot have children. They're not ordered towards the ends or good of marriage, whereas a man and woman are. So an analogy we give in the book that comes from the book, What is Marriage? Is baseball. What makes a baseball team a baseball team? It's not just the activities in playing baseball. You know, so a baseball team is when you hit balls with a bat and you catch balls and you run around a field. That's a part of it. But nine guys catching pop flies on a Saturday afternoon is not a baseball team. They're having fun, and that's fine. A baseball team is ordered towards the goal of winning games, and they're still a team even if they have a shutout season. So much the same way, a married couple is a marriage because the man and woman are ordered towards the complete gift of self that leads to the creation of a new human life, even if they never end up reaching that goal.
You can't have the too few players to play in the team. You can't be missing a batter to play in the team. Just like marriage, you have to have male and female, right, all the right points.
I remember reading an article in The Atlantic that criticized, because this comes from Robbie George, Sharif Gerges, and Ryan Anderson's book, What is Marriage? Right. And this defender of so-called same-sex marriage criticized this analogy. And he said, oh, great from George et al. That an infertile couple is like a losing baseball team. How sensitive to say these people are losers. They didn't.
That's not what he said at
all. No, he didn't say that. But the analogy works in our favor because an infertile couple does feel a legitimate sense of loss. That it does not make sense for a same-sex couple to grieve the fact they are unable to have children. That would be like me grieving the fact that I cannot fly. I mean, you understand there's a lot of LA traffic to get here to the studio. It would have been easy to fly here. I don't grieve that I can't fly. It's not within my nature to do that. But we would be sad if we saw a bird, like an eagle with an injured wing that couldn't fly.
Because they're made to fly.
They're made for that. And so it's the same with a married couple. They're ordered towards that particular conjugal end. And marriage itself, marriage doesn't make sense. Why do we need marriage if marriage is just about celebrating adult relationships? We manage all of our other adult relationships without certificates and government intervention. You and I can be friends, and I don't have to go down to the Orange County Courthouse and get a friendship certificate for us. And we don't have to go and dissolve it if things, you know, we have a falling out. Why do we need that? That's the nature of adult relationships. We need government intervention. We need these things because it's for the good of society as a whole to keep men and women together when they're capable of creating children.
These are great examples because it's reminding the kids there's purpose to your body. There's purpose to who you are. And everything in society, you can look at all of creation, that if we can create as humans something to work in a specific way, whether it's a car or a baseball team, that God can create something all the more to have a specific purpose.
That's right.
And, you know, even looking at how the animals are interacting with one another, how plants at all costs are trying to fertilize the earth. I mean, we could go on and on with these examples.
Sure.
And kids get it. And I think sometimes we overcomplicate it. And so that's why I love your book, because it's telling parents, you can do this.
Yes.
You may need some tools, right, in that tool belt, but you can do this. You're equipped. You were chosen to be this child's parent.
God chose you to be this child's parent. He could have chosen anyone else to do that. He could have chosen not to give you a child. He has chosen for other people not to give them children. And that is his blessing. Children are not something we have a right to. They are a blessing that we receive. The second we imagine children are something we have a right to have is the second we turn children into a commodity and reduce their intrinsic value and their worth. So if you do have children, it's because God chose to bless you with children in spite of your weaknesses. He knows that. But he's willing to help you grow and be perfected in those weaknesses if you'll be open to God's grace to be able to do that. And then in the book, we give just simple tips to help do that. And at the end of the day, I think asking questions are helpful. You can ask your child, well, what is marriage for? Why do we have something like marriage? And we go through tips in the book on how to show the most plausible answer is that marriage is for uniting men and women.
What other issues do you cover in the book? I know you talk about abortion, transgenderism, same-sex marriage, and same-sex attraction, all separate issues. What else do you talk about?
We talk about contraception. We talk about pornography, divorce. We talk, you know, the hardest chapter in the book was to write was modesty. We wrote about modesty because I know there are some Catholic parents, if I cross the line on modesty with them, one way too conservative or not, they will, you know, get their pitchforks and torches ready.
You can't really ever make people happy on modesty.
No, you can't. That's why in our chapter on modesty, we don't say, here's how many inches above or below the knee a dress should be. It's not what we say. We talk about the principles of why modesty matters, what modesty is for, how modesty is more than clothing, and how to explain that to little kids and to bigger kids. But it was a challenging chapter.
You know, right? And I think that's the problem is that we reduce modesty only to clothing, but modesty is a virtue, right?
Yeah,
modesty is a virtue.
Modesty is just about not revealing that which should remain hidden.
Right. And it's how we stand, how we talk, how we interact with certain people and shouldn't interact with other people in a specific type of way. And I think if we begin to have that type of mindset, it changes how we interact with others on the issue of modesty.
Right. Because we talk about in the book for advice for little kids with modesty. It's not just an issue for girls. You should teach boys to be modest, not to talk about scatological functions and gross out humor, and to help them learn that might be funny in certain contexts, but you know, that's something that's private. And so private things ought to remain private. And then teaching the boys as they get older how to not objectify women. When modesty comes up, there's this debate. Don't tell women what to wear. Tell the boys not to stare. And you get these little chants. And I'll give you, it's catchy. I'll give you that. But I say that's not either or. We can teach the boys not to stare, but we should teach men not to objectify women, and we should teach women not to objectify themselves. The two go hand in hand.
I mean, they're both extremes, telling boys not to stare and then blaming all of it on the women.
Oh, yeah, saying that men are helpless brutes and that we will come unglued and we can't be held responsible for our actions. That's a word I probably can't utter on air. That's ludicrous. There I can say that it's ludicrous. It's absurd that men can be held to high standards of morality and virtue to protect people, to protect other men, women, and children. And women can be held to virtue as well. Paul says in Galatians 6:2, we should bear burdens for one another. And so that means that men should not objectify women, and women should bear the burdens men have in being visual creatures, and be cognizant of that and be kind and not make things an unnecessary burden with overly revealing clothing. And remember, of course, that the body speaks a language. That we think in sex that, like, well, sex is a context I can turn on and off in situations. When I wear a bikini at the beach, it's fun.
You wear a bikini to the beach, Trent?
Well, in the hypothetical example.
I'd like to see that.
We haven't gotten there yet. We'll see what happens in California. You never know.
I mean, that would be more than the Speedo.
That would, you're right. A bikini would be more modest than a Speedo. So, but even there, what's funny is men and women are wired differently. A bikini is an occasion of lust, of sinning by lust for men. A Speedo is an occasion of sinning by verbal abuse by women and mockery and degradation. So, but to say that in these outsets, yeah, we'll bear one another's burden. And no, in the context, what I wear, my body speaks a language, regardless of what I want it to say at that point, and to know the body that we are not repressive Puritan thinkers. We're not anti-sex or anti the body. In fact, what we believe is the body is sexual by nature past puberty. And I mean, sexual entirely, but it becomes more revealed after puberty. And so we have to be cognizant of that and to reveal our sexuality in appropriate times and places. That is the nature of the essence of chastity.
See, and I think that talking about modesty with little children, for me personally, I see it as the heart of the entire issue of sexual immorality. Because if you begin to respect your body, and even helping little kids, because sexual abuse is so prevalent in our culture.
Yes.
It's not just in the church. It's not just in the public school system. And I would hope that we would be able to teach children to know that certain types of touching is not okay, both among their peers and with adults.
Yeah, and you could say it is that it's not that your body is a bad thing. You can say that, no, you should, that's a private, special part of you. Or to say, especially as girls get older, say, this is a mystery. I hate the phrase, modest is hottest. I think it's just dumb.
Dumb,
I agree. I like the idea that of mystery, not modesty. You can be an alluring, attractive woman who dresses in a way that you show there is a mysterious beauty about you, to be attractive in that way without making yourself cheap in that regard. And so that's, I think, the message that we can, talk about that mystery. And even little kids, guard your mystery. Be sure to treat yourself as being valuable as the treasure you are.
And I know some people, that language doesn't appeal to them. I get it. Because I know there's a lot of sensitivity in terms of language on the issue of modesty. But this book really does give you some great ideas, some foundational tools for young children and your teenagers. So we're talking about Trent Horn's book, Made This Way. You can find Trent Horn at Catholic Answers. And what's your website for where people can listen to your podcast?
Sure. That's available at trenthornpodcast.com.
Excellent. And we'll have all links to Trent's products, both his books and his podcast, at radiotrending.com underneath the notes for the episode.
This has been Trending with Timory. To learn more about Timory Millington, visit timory.com.